So I said before that if I needed a lawyer, I wouldn't know where to go. So I'm very thankful that Nathan McPherson and the McPherson Group are supporting Raw, because it just so happens that within a few weeks of them reaching out to advertise here, I needed a lawyer. And I can tell you, so far, the McPherson Group has been fantastic. They've taken what was a complex, not dangerous, but complex situation, and strategically, quickly, fixed it. You can find them at beatirs.com. That's BEATIRS.com, or you can call them 1-800-BEATIRS. They specialize in tax law and are more than happy to help mom-and-pop clients, homeowners, pastors, and churches deal with any thorny issues that might come up. One small business in Wisconsin that allegedly owed over $30,000 was able to settle for 0.33 cents on the dollar. That's $100 was the final settlement. They wrote, "Nathan, thank you so much for helping me in this whole thing. May God bless you and your business." Again, the McPherson Group, beatirs.com, 1-800-BEAT-IRS. I tell you, I'm a fan. So this week, I feel like I'm going to be cheating a little bit. Last week, I didn't even put out a podcast. Ha! What I'm finding is that as I settle into my work here in Rockford, Illinois, this transition, we've talked about it before and I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about it now, but what I'm finding is that I am so strangely contented with the work of a pastor's life that I kind of don't want to do anything else. It's not like I'm just dying to go do the pastor work either. Don't get me wrong. I'm not insane. We all have a relationship with our vocation, with our work, in which we want to do things and then we don't want to do things, right? But what I'm finding is that after the catalyzing chaos of 6, 7, 8 years of Worldview Everlasting that propelled me kind of into a bit of the eyesight of people, it's why you're listening to this podcast. Whether you know it or not, that it is Worldview Everlasting and what happened there that made my voice one that you would listen to on your machine right now. But as I was doing that, and then as I saw the dissolution of Worldview Everlasting coming, I really felt like I had to do more, right? I couldn't let this happen. And now that I've let it happen, part of me is just kind of glad to have it be gone. and glad to just not have to do something every week that is media-oriented and media-driven. And yet I do know I have a love for this, so I don't want it to go away. And I want to, in fact, I have plans to keep doing this. But for whatever reason, at least, is it the summertime? You know, I just have really found a lackadaisical bone when it comes to this particular kind of work. Well, for what it's worth. So I'm cheating this week because I cheated last week by not doing anything, and I don't think that's quite fair, quite right for those of you particularly who are pledging your support. But this week what I'm going to do is give you something, but it's mostly that the majority of it is going to be something you can find somewhere else. That is, I was a guest on somebody else's show earlier this week on a Monday, and there's some real irony in this. It's someone else's show that used to be my show. how the world turns. Pastor Brian Wolfmuller invited me to be his guest on Cross Defense, which he is currently hosting for KFUO Radio, to talk about to talk about Echo. Now, if you've been listening to this, you've heard me talk about Echo before, but he got into a couple of different directions with the book and with the writing of the book. So I think it's worth listening to. I think it was new material. And so that's what the first 45 minutes of this is going to be. But then he asks a question near the end of the show that I just go off on this story tangent about. It was a good question, and I think it's kind of an interesting story. The problem was that we basically run out of time. So I'm going to play the episode as it is, but then with the story kind of running out of time, I'm going to come back at the end of this and add a little bit more to kind of close up the story and maybe make it a little less about Jonathan Fisk's creative process and make it a little bit more about the content that the creative process is trying to bring forward to you. So for the moment, here is Brian Wolfmuller's Cross Defense, and I'll see you on the other side.
I'm Pastor Brian Wolfmuller. You are listening to Cross Defense. We're going to go to a short break, and we're going to be back on the other side with my great friend, Pastor Jonathan Fisk, talking about his book, Echo. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Cross Defense on KFUO. I'm your host, Pastor Brian Wolfmuller, pastor of Hope Lutheran Church in Aurora, Colorado. And I have hanging around somehow on the other end of a microphone, Pastor Jonathan Fisk. Pastor Fisk, how are you?
I'm doing all right, Brian. Pastor Wolfmuller, good to hear your voice.
You too. Thanks for being on the show. I want to talk to you about this book, Echo, which is fantastic. I mean, I really, you know, you wrote another book, which I read at some point, and I thought, that's a pretty good book. But then I picked up this guy, and it's totally different. So you had Broken, which was great, but now this is the second book. And as I've talked to people, I'm going to kind of start with this, who have read it, they've all commented on the same thing. They've said the same thing that you've said to me, that this is a very different book, a very different project. What's the difference between Broken and Echo?
Focus. You know, Broken was a book written by a young man. I was in my early 30s, and I aspired to be a writer and liked to write. But I, you know, as you age, whatever craft you practice, you get better at it. And so, I honestly, one of the biggest differences is that while Broken does have a real theme to it, a real direction, it's not as if it isn't got a locus or a section of ideas that it deals with. It does kind of meander and takes you on a journey and finds its way as it goes. And Echo comes at you with a pretty clear plan. And that plan is historic theology is what we have always believed as Christians, and then that means as Lutherans. But it's very direct, and it just moves right through giving you this kind of gold mine that the Catechism is and laying it out in its structure. So, and then the fact that the Catechism is so structured by God, I think, and that the book's about that structure even amplifies that, so that you really never go more than a page or two in doubt of where you're going, right? In fact, I'm at pains to try to hide from you where you're going a little bit, but it's just so evident what's being talked about. And Broken was, again, it was just a little more, it was more like a narrative, right? It was more of an adventure. They also did deal with different topics in a sense, although they really do have the same ultimate message. But you were just talking about the conscience for a while there, and Broken very much has as its fundamental concept the freedom of the conscience of the Christian, and trying to help Christians reckon with what that means apologetically in their own hearts, like how they would make a defense of their conscience to themselves while out in the world on the basis of what Christianity means, right? So that they would not be plagued by false teaching. And Echo, while that certainly is still there as part of Christianity, its central driving point is the centrality of Jesus of Nazareth at the heart, the beating heart of history, the beating heart of our faith, and the beating heart of the design of the world, and then how that world has been redeemed in him. That's why we have a clean conscience. That's why what Broken says about the freedom of the Christian conscience can be true. But Echo is really trying to demonstrate the reasonableness of this claim and the simplicity of this claim, that it is not only historical and defensible, but that it's enough for a child to learn at the most fundamental level, and yet it's enough to continue to challenge an adult to realize I'm always a student of this thing. I never get much further. Now, that's my opinion in answer to your question. I could be wrong. Echo is just a better book. But I think that has a lot to do with the fact that I was 7 years older when I wrote it. But yeah, for what it's worth.
You start out by talking about, and so I mean, in some ways, I mean, one of the things you've always been good at, I've admired this about you, even though I make fun of you for it. But I have secretly, I didn't want you to know that I admire. But now we're talking to the world, so
that's
I admire
right.
you.
But before this, you called me your great friend, and I'm like, man, I'm not just a friend, but I'm great, right? Like I have this friend, and he's great. I have this friend, and he's regular, and Fisk is like, great. I'm friends with a great guy.
Well,
so anyway,
I don't know if the great was a description of you or of the friendship. I'm trying to figure that
me.
Out. I'm starting to talk more like Trump, you know. I got a tremendous friend, just one of the best, and I was talking to him the other day. So, this talent of yours and interest of yours is being able to take the language that we're used to using in the church and just twisting it, giving to it new words. I mean, looking at, and a lot of times you're peeling back, you're going to the Greek, you're pulling out the text and bringing across a cognate so that one of the great dangers of theology, right, is that we become bored with it. We think that we know it. And Luther talked about that too. He says, you know, people think they read the catechism one time and they think they've learned it. And we can't be finished learning what God never finishes teaching. In fact, don't you start the book with that phrase quote from Luther?
I mean, the book is the result of 15 years of that phrase convicting me back when I was just a seminarian and telling me, you know, this is you arrogant jerk. You think you understand this stuff. You don't have a clue, is what Luther says in the Large Catechism. He says it nicer than that, but in a very convicting way, and that's how I took it for myself. And so I've been on this journey of sorts to try to believe that there's more there than I saw when I was a bored seventh grader, you know, in a hot, dusty room on a warm Wednesday afternoons, wanting to get out of there, wanting to, you know, get me confirmed so I can be done with this church stuff. There's more there. And going in and finding it, and then trying to, once I found it, share it. So it is an interest of mine in this sense. I want to understand it. And so for me to understand it, you can't just repeat the phrases ad nauseum and expect that to give you more understanding. If you want to study something, you need more than one line about that thing. You can't just know one fact. You need a book, or you need a resource, you need a series of tests or what have you. And so for me, since we are a people of the word, we live from this word, to understand this word means to find what it means. And that means more words, other words, whether they're words of history that give us the word that we have now, that study of etymology is a pretty boring sounding word, but I love it, right? That you find out where the word came from, and it helps you understand why we use this sound to mean this thing over there, all the way down to other words, like in our language, in English, we have so many different ways of saying the same thing. It's very unique. Not all languages are so profuse. and yet, with that, we can describe things so well and to be able to use that. There's a great danger here, though, too. You told me just a moment ago, you said, you know, I twist the words. And it's like, ooh, what's that mean, right? Because historically, we have very good and important warnings from doctors of the church not to change the words. Don't tinker with the words, because there are always arising from within the church false teachers who twist the word to their own destruction and the destruction of others, right? And so there is a danger there, but I would like to emphasize that there is a distinction between twisting and translating. And that what Echo is trying to do is not twist the words. Maybe twist the sounds a little bit, but not the words. What it wants to do is to translate the words so that I don't just have a cursory or a surface-level understanding of what it means, you shall not murder, and walk away thinking, as long as I've never actually stabbed someone in the chest or shot him in the face, I'm not a murderer, right? That's what Jesus does with the Sermon on the Mount. So trying to take that tact, not only to you shall not murder, but to things like hallowed be thy name, or things like he suffered, right? That Jesus suffered. That, to me, that's my favorite part of the whole book, because it, for me, it was such a revelation to see the suffering of Jesus as an act of righteous work that he did for me from the moment he took his first breath all the way to the last breath he took, you know, and that he was carrying the thorns of the world all the way to that cross to buy them back, that kind of stuff. To have those words opened up to us a little bit more. So I don't know if I'd call it a gift so much. I mean, if it is for others, that's great. But for me, I'm just a dunce and I want to understand these things, and I can't unless I have more words. And now I'm just trying to share what I found.
It reminds me of what Luther says in his Great Confession, that he's worried that people are going to come around after he dies and say, oh, Luther didn't go far enough. He didn't know these things. That's why he still said that the body and blood was in the supper and things like that. And Luther says, I want you to know that I've climbed the tree of Scripture, I've gone to the end of every branch, and I've looked at both sides of every leaf. so that he, you know, that our investigation of the Scriptures is a thorough investigation, that we've turned over every single word in there. We've looked at every single leaf. And I think in some ways, I see this project of yours is going to the end of the branch of the catechism and flipping over every leaf, every word that's in there, and dislodging the cliches so that we can have a fresh take at it. So just as an example, I think one of our problems is we think of the Ten Commandments like, I think our common understanding of the Ten Commandments is like the rules that are posted outside of the hotel swimming pool, you know?
Yeah, right.
Pool is open till 10 o'clock. No glass allowed in swimming area. You must rest for 30 minutes before you swim. If you're under 12, you have to have adult supervision. In other words, it's just kind of a, you know, it's just a list of do's and don'ts, and it doesn't go any further than that. You come along and you call them the 10 parts of being creation. In other words, you're just taking those 10 commandments and you're pushing it down to the, you know, past the kind of, I suppose, bland moralism to the very fundamental point of what it means to be created by God. So something about that. What do you?
Well, my thinking of that is that even the rules of the swimming pool, as much as I might like to have a glass to drink out of, right? There's a reason that the rule is there. So there are no rules posted generally anywhere in life that don't have an assumption or a presupposition behind them. There's a bit of positive information behind the do not. And that positive information, which is a known thing, that is why we would have a do not, is why we would keep the rule. And so any list of rules is going to be arbitrary. It's going to be annoying. It's like, why do I have to do this if you don't have the why behind it, right? That positive information that helps explain the need for or the benefit of the boundary line and the boundary marker, right? So why would you not have glass at a pool? Well, it's because in the past people drop their glass and it breaks, and then some of it gets in the pool and you can't get it out because then it's in the water, and then people swim and they have glass slivers in their feet and it's really awful, right? So that's why. Yeah, and then it's like, okay, I can see that. Maybe I shouldn't do that. Okay, well, so then let's do that with the Ten Commandments. And you find it's a little bit bigger than we want people not to have glass shards in their feet. Not that that's a bad thing. I think that's a laudable goal. But it's far more profound than that. It's far more cosmological than that. That the presuppositions that the Ten Commandments themselves are built on are the definition of life in the universe for humans as a whole, start to finish. Right. There is nothing about our existence as human beings in this, I'll even go so far as to say multiverse, if you want to believe something like that exists. There is nothing that those Ten Commandments don't describe in some way. They cover everything, and everything dovetails into them. And that's where the genius of it is, that these categories are at once so narrow that we can think, oh yeah, don't do that. At the other hand, they're so broad that there's nothing in life that's not encompassed by them in some way, shape, or form.
There's something there. I don't even know how to get to it with a question. So maybe I just want to kind of push you in this direction. I remember Dr. Kleinig told me a story. I was there. He was telling the story about when he was teaching confirmation a couple of years ago. Now, so Dr. Kleinig, for the listeners, he's a great professor of theology down in Australia. He's written numbers of commentaries. He spent most of his life preparing pastors at the seminary in Adelaide, Australia, but then he retired, and he was helping at a church, and he was teaching youth confirmation, which is something he hadn't done in a generation. And as he taught the catechism, the kids, he kind of circled back around after it was over, and he says, "What was your favorite part?" And the kids said, against all of his expectations, that my favorite part was the Ten Commandments. Which we would just, I mean, if you were guessing, what's going to people's favorite part is going to be the gospel, the forgiveness of sins, that I'm made new in Christ. And he was surprised, and he said, why? And the answer that was given is, in one way or another, pointing to the fact that their lives, the kids' lives, are so disordered and so confused that to have a sense that this universe is, in fact, ordered by God, and that we can get access to that ordering through the Ten Commandments, was an incredible existential relief. And I think that you kind of instinctively have that sense also, and I'm wondering if you want to, I mean, there's this way in that the world seems so disordered to us that we have to recover the idea that the Ten Commandments are much more than the do's and don'ts, but are the kind of fundamental cosmic realities of God's creation.
Yeah, or it's OCD, right? The instinctive sense that you need a little more control over what's going on.
Yeah.
No, I maybe the rise of things like obsessive compulsive disorders, attention deficit disorders. I'm not convinced these are all physical maladies. Certainly there are situations where they are, but it's such a wide sweeping thing, and I am convinced that it is connected to the loss of transcendent meaning in our existence as Western humans. We're now kind of a melting pot of West and East. But why is Eastern thought and Eastern philosophy having such a powerful impact on Western culture? It's because it does provide some answer, or at least it seeks to provide an answer to give a meaning for the existence here. Or little thing that I heard years ago, so it may not be as true as it was 5-6 years ago when I heard it, but that the largest conversion numbers of anybody in Britain to any one religion at that time is 20-year-old white males, and they're converting to Islam. And it's a stunning thought. And the reasoning behind it is not that Islam is true, per se, that's what they think, but that Islam is not afraid to say that it is true. It says it unabashedly. It says it so much that you can leave. If you're in my building right now and you don't like what I said, then go away. Get out of here, you infidel, right? And that for these young people who are swimming in tolerance, right? Like everything is tolerated. There is no rhyme or reason. There is no stability. There's nowhere to put your feet. There's nowhere to put your hands. You don't know which way is up. For to have anybody just say, we know what's going on and we're not going to change it, that conviction alone is a powerful relief. And then they'll jump into it. And then, of course, Islam does have a certain semblance of the Ten Commandments. They have a certain understanding or building upon this design, which they teach as a moral reality. And so, they're drawn to that. So it's not entirely surprising to me that young people in the United States today who have so much freedom, freedom of thought, really, and I don't mean this in a good way, like that they're not told no by their parents, generally speaking, at least until they're 16. Then they try to tell them no suddenly and it's a fight, right? But they're not told no for years. And so they don't know. They're insecure because in order to learn what reality is, you have to have yes and no. There has to be light and darkness, right? You have to have on and off. Otherwise, you can't understand. And that lack of understanding means like it's an internal or a spiritual falling. It's like you're constantly unable to get your bearings. You know what it's like when you fall and you like reach back? You know, a lot of people break their arm because you reach back to catch yourself in some way. And if you just fall on your back, you'd be fine. But that's like what you're doing is you're flailing around trying to find something to hold on to. And Christianity has that. But we also have positioned ourselves. I'm not speaking for every church and every Christian. But as a movement within Western civilization, we have positioned ourselves as the only people alive who have nothing substantial to say. Like the only religion that really doesn't believe anything at all. So, you know, just come be nice with us on a Sunday morning. Oh, yeah, give some money, too. It doesn't really work.
Yeah.
Yeah? Go respond to that a little bit.
No, I'm gonna go to the break is what I'm going to do is right now and come back to talk about this on the other side. This is really great, though. I mean, Pastor Fisk, this is Pastor Brian Wolfman, by the way, that you're listening to, and that's Pastor Jonathan Fisk over there talking about his book Echo, which is a real gift to the church. I mean, just a phenomenal piece of work, and it's great to hear you talk about it, and we're going to talk about it some more. So we're going to go to the break now. We'll be back in like 90 seconds, something like that. Can't ever remember how long the breaks are, but I think 90 seconds. Stick with us. Be back on the other side and talk some more about this, how Christianity has something solid not only to place our feet on, to place our minds on, to place our conscience on, to place our trust in. That's what Christianity gives us. That's what Jesus gives us in his blood. Stay tuned. We'll be back soon.
I'm World Lutheran News Digest host Kip Allen. Every day, things happen that affect the lives of Lutherans worldwide. Whether it's mercy efforts to a disaster-stricken community, threats to religious liberty, or cultural trends, World Lutheran News Digest takes an in-depth look at one issue each week as I interview newsmakers and experts, while Sarah Golseth presents a quick look at the week's news. World Lutheran News Digest may be heard every Wednesday at 2:30 and Saturday at 9:30 on Worldwide KFUO.
When you went car shopping, you meant business. You ace vehicle history searches and test drives. You out salesman to the salesman. Now you've got your wheels. If you manage that, you can get your retirement plan on track. Visiting aceyourretirement.org can help. With 401k tips and smart savings strategies, you'll have the info you need to get more for your future. Go to aceyourretirement.org, because when it comes to speeding past financial challenges, you're an ace. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
When Martin Luther King Jr. delivered his now iconic I Have a Dream speech, it was a defining moment in the civil rights movement. A speech rich in biblical language, as he quoted from numerous biblical passages, including Amos 5:24.
No, we are not satisfied, and we will not be satisfied until justice rolls down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream.
And from Isaiah 40.
I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted. Every hill and mountain shall be made low. The rough places will be made plain, and the crooked places will be made straight.
Martin Luther King Jr. used biblical language to inspire a generation to stand up to injustice and to hope for a better future. Engage with the Bible. Let its language inspire you to create a better future.
Brought to you by Museum of the Bible.
Welcome back to Cross the Fence. I'm Pastor Brian Wolfmuller, the pastor of Hope Lutheran Church in Aurora, Colorado. I have Pastor Jonathan Fisk with me, who is the author of this new book, my tremendous friend, my huge great friend, Pastor Jonathan Fisk, and the author of this tremendous, never better book.
Huge and great. It's awesome.
And tremendous. Echo, which is really a great book. In fact, I've been, I was just telling Pastor Fisk, I think this is going to work. We're going to try to get a copy of this book sponsored to every incoming freshman of the Concordia systems. We're still working on a plan to get that done, but if people are interested, I'll post something up about that on the blog, which is wolfmuller.co, wolfmuller.co. I think we'll have some details finalized tomorrow, so keep an eye out in the next week for that. I'll announce it here on Cross Defense as well, because I think this book is so helpful. I mean, one of the dangers, we were talking about this before, one of the dangers of Christianity, of theology, is that we think we've learned it, and so we go through catechism class, and now we think we've got it, and we have to fight against that kind of theological sloth or boredom or acadia, the old guys called it, and to reinvigorate our imagination with the truths of Christianity, which are not only the truest of all truths, if you can say something like that, but they are the best of all truth. The truth is always the best. The things that are true are always the things that are the most beautiful, and that's certainly true of the Ten Commandments, and especially of the Creed, the gift of the gospel that the Lord Jesus gives to us. If you're all right, Pastor Fisk, I'm going to take a step down the road here from what we were talking about before to something I want to talk about next. You all right with that? We move on?
Yeah. I want to say what I think is neat about your plan to get this book in people's hands. And it's not just about, you know, having something that I wrote do well. That's a nice thing when it is. But yeah, I think what the catechism itself has is the ability to unify people. It is a simple expression of the belief that Jesus says, I will draw all men to myself, and if you love me, you will keep my words. And the catechism historically is the most boiled down words for us to be together on, for us to have a common union with. And what Echo is trying to do is to give us American language for those words. And to have that happen to a whole generation of people at the time when they're most ready to have their minds formed, it's not a book you have to be a hyper-Lutheran, you know, liturgista, you know, kind of a Nazi for worship styles to get something out of you. You don't even have to be a Lutheran at all, I don't think. I think you could be of a number of different groups and read this. You'd get Lutheranism out of it because the catechism is the foundation. But my point is, you can be on different sides of the political spectrums within, say, the Missouri Synod, and yet this book would bring us closer together and would enable us, I think, if we all had this mind that comes from the catechism, not from me, but from the catechism, I think we would be enabled to see where we stand in these dark and evil days and make a good punch at the world that's out there. I'd love to see what would happen if a generation of people had that toolbox at their ready, what they would do with it.
I am interested in that as well. Because, you know, one of the problems in the church is we resent the generation ahead of us and we despise the generation after us. I mean, that's what just kind of this generational pride thing that we have. And so the people in the church, you know, they look at the people that have gone on before and like, they just didn't understand it. Everyone looks at the generations above and says, they just didn't get it. And then we look at the generations below and we say, they'll never get it. Both of those are wrong, absolutely wrong. So we look at the generation above us and we rejoice in all the things that they could see and do, that they could suffer and endure. And then we look at the generation below us and we think, here, this is the next generation is the generation that Jesus has chosen to handle all of the stuff that's coming at the end of the world. I mean, we think, who would God put to handle the gray and latter days? And for a while, we could think, well, it was us. But now we're getting old and another generation is being raised up. And apparently, the Lord has appointed them to deal with the end of the world. And so to honor them for that and to hand them the tools that they need to not only face the judgment day, but to face the chaos that comes before the judgment day. I mean, that's really the task that the Lord has set before us. So we got to do it. Okay, I'm going to read a passage from your book. This is from page... Oh, now I can't see what page it's from. It got cut off on the picture. It's about the second foundational reality. And you write this. This is, in fact, stunning. It's not the history of Jesus that defies the law and structure of the universe. It's not his resurrection from the dead that's unbelievable. It's not his incarnation's inversion of physics, time, and space that truly breaks the mold of human reason. Rather, it is the fact that God could have built a second creation from scratch, right at the beginning, right when we fell. He could have swept aside the old, broken order of the 10 things and made a new order, perfected to stand on his own, but he didn't. Instead, he spoke the second foundational reality into the midst of the first one. Rather than to destroy our less than good, but now worse and certainly not very good anymore universe, he fulfilled and completed it. He looked down on the world that wanted to be its own God, the man who wanted to replace the God who made all things, and in his mind-bending mercy, he chose to become one with us to save us from the attempt. He overturned and absorbed the thorniness of Adam, the brokenness of earth, by taking humanity up into himself. That is just, first of all, that's fantastic writing, by the way.
Thank you.
And second of all, it's even, I mean, the thing that you're writing about is even better. I mean, it's just an amazing thing to say that God could. I mean, the surprising thing is not that God became a man. The surprising thing is not that the incarnation and the death and resurrection of Jesus. The surprising thing is that it all comes from his mercy. I mean, that he could have just walloped us. He should have just walloped us. I mean, he should have ended it all right at the very beginning, but he didn't. I mean, he decided to do something different. That's phenomenal. Yes. You want to expand on that?
Well, it's what we would do, right? We wouldn't do mercy. There's a reason that the name Hitler is so polemical today and that it gets thrown around, or Nazi, right? What does that word Nazi mean today? It doesn't really mean a historical group of people who did a historical evil thing. What a Nazi is someone who's unforgivable. They have treaded over the line between good and evil to where there is nothing that can make us forgive them. What they have done is so terrible. What Hitler has done is so terrible that every human being must, from the heart, despise him. And it's sort of just kind of the way the language has come down to us now. And what's important is for you to see that in this scenario, God and you, you're Hitler. You're the Nazi. Like, you're worse. You're even further removed from the good God. And his gut reaction is not to call you what you are and give you what you deserve. His gut reaction, his first step, is to save you, to love you, to forgive you. That's godly, right? It's inhuman at the highest level. But it's not inhuman in a sense of as if humans weren't created to have this kind of mercy. But fallen humans, we just don't know this kind of mercy. We don't. It doesn't come from us. Even when we show mercy, it's with hesitance, and with catches and limits, right? How many times must I forgive my brother? That kind of thing. And yeah, you're right. The most surprising, marvelous thing about God, you know, who is he? Right? I am the Lord, Yahweh. I am the Lord, filled with steadfast love. Right? We don't translate that word particularly excitingly. Unyielding fidelity, a commitment that never dies. Always for you, never against you. That's who I am from the root. And that's why everything else that Jesus does and did and will do happens, is because his inclination is to give rather than to receive. And when Jesus says it's better to give than receive, we kind of trance that around like a bunch of pious mumbo jumbo. Yeah, I ought to give a little bit more. We should all give a little. No, he's talking about himself. He didn't come to take anything. He came to give because that's what he does. And he thinks it's so good. It's so good that's all he wants to do. He never wants to receive again. And we're like, great, give us some. Right? Yeah. We just don't have any of that native give in us. The beautiful thing about the design of creation being restored to the last day is that's all we're going to know is that kind of giving. That's going to be what we're built from, because we're going to be built from him.
Yeah, stunning. Yeah, Jesus says, "What's who's greater, the one who sits at the table, the one who serves? But I am among you as the one who serves." He says it in yeah. Mark like this. I did not come to be served, but to serve and to give my life as a ransom for many. Is it that this is precisely who Jesus is, so that when the prophets say stuff like, my thoughts are not your thoughts and my ways are not your ways, my thoughts are higher than your thoughts, we normally think, well, that means God is a lot smarter than us. Like, God can figure out how to invent a black hole or whatever, which is true, no doubt. It's true, but that's not what it means. His thoughts are higher than our thoughts because his thoughts are on mercy. I mean, his thoughts are higher than our thoughts because he says, I'm going to become one of you, bear your sin, suffer in your place, and die for you to save you. His thoughts are higher than our thoughts because our thoughts are almost all law, self-centered, vindictive law, and his thoughts are gospel. I mean, his thoughts are mercy. It's just, and that's why it's such a surprise, right? I mean, every page of the scripture, just like every page of your book has this, a little bit of this in it too, but every page of the scripture especially has a surprise on it. I mean, this is, God never acts like how we would predict or how we would think he's going to act, but he acts totally differently because he acts in mercy. He acts in kindness, in love, and self-sacrifice. Like you said, he acts always in giving.
Yeah, it's an endless thing, and he has no bottom to that gift. And again, the stunning part is this too shows us our sin, right? It shows us how wicked we are, that we can't even conceive of that kind of giving. And yet, here he is drawing us alongside himself, saying, you know, fear not, little flock, I've got you. Yeah.
I remember when you were talking about this book in the beginning, do I remember this right or not? But did it first come out, you were thinking about doing something just on the Lord's Prayer? Or was the Lord's Prayer like a particularly central part of what you were thinking about?
Yes and no. That's a kind of a long story. When I finished Broken, I knew I wanted to write more. It wasn't like I just had a book that I wrote. I've had a lifelong desire to be what you would call a writer. It was a dream. I went to school, and before I was going to the seminary, I wanted to be a fiction writer. So I knew I wanted to write books. So when I had a first one, and it was fairly successful for Lutheran standards, I knew I needed to write another book, right? You got to keep going. And I probably waited about 6 months before I started in on something called Welcome to the Resistance. And I had a big plan for Welcome to the Resistance, and I worked on that plan, and I fuddled with that plan for about 5 years and just couldn't ever get very far on it. And the plan was this. The plan was to present you with sort of a handbook for Christian life, right? Or kind of everything, the subtitle, Welcome to the Resistance, The Sojourner's Guide to the Galactic War. Everything you need to know about being a Christian in an age of darkness and decay, kind of summed up. And I was using as my model the idea that I think made Rick Warren's purpose-driven life so very successful. What Rick Warren's purpose-driven life is, more or less, is a Baptist dogmatics that doesn't ever tell you it's a Baptist dogmatics. It instead just tells you that it's practical truth. And it brings you a bunch of assumptions from Baptist theology, some of which is biblical and some of which is not. So, well, God, it'd be great to do that with Lutheran theology, because then you'd have the real deal. right? To have a Lutheran dogmatics, which is not going to tell you that you're absorbing Lutheran doctrine in. So I'm working on this thing. But the thing is, because Warren's work was so great, so good, so not great and good in the sense that I agree with it, but it's popular and it did so well, I sort of was using his book as a model. And so I was using his categories, like the big setup of the whole book was sort of similar to the way he set his book up. And I kept banging my head against this thing. And then finally I sat back and said, wait a minute. If he's bringing me a Baptist dogmatics, that means it's not like it's just the words on the page are Baptist understanding. It means all the categories are Baptist categories. Where he starts is where Baptist theology starts, and where he finishes is where Baptist theology wants to finish. So I can't use his book as a model at all. I have to find Lutheran categories and put them in that function. So I'm like, okay, well, what do I use Dr. Francis Pieper's Christian dogmatics? Is that what we do? And it kind of just dawned on me. Wait a minute. Our catechism is our categories. It's all of them. It's such a simple little tool, right? And so then what happened then, in a sense, was I realized that this trying to teach the theology of the catechism was shoved inside of this other handbook for living thing that I had. And at the same time, this is where the Lord's Prayer part comes in, right? Right as I'm having this revelation, I'm asked to speak at the Issues at Center of Making the Case conference. It's about 3 years ago now. And they asked you, if I recall, to talk about eschatology in the book of Revelation, which was like my cherry-picked plan, right? That's what I like to do, is talk about Revelation. It's my hobby. And I'm like, oh, man, Brian got a good topic. What are they going to give me? And they asked me to talk about the Lord's Prayer. And I know nothing about the Lord's Prayer. I'm like, I couldn't talk for 5 minutes about the Lord's Prayer. I mean, I could teach catechism class on it, right? But I wasn't ready to really dive into an hour-long presentation on this in front of a big audience. But as I then studied and prepared for that, I began to really just find things in the Lord's Prayer from the large catechism largely, but elsewhere that I had never seen before. And then that talk, which was received very well, dovetailed into me using Ten Commandments, Creed, and Lord's Prayer as the totality of this book. So really the back end of this book is a flushing out of that talk. And then the front end of this book and all these pictures, they're connected to another thing that when I started teaching confirmation class years ago, I would use these stick figures to kind of try to draw pictures of each commandment or each piece that was happening to try to give a visual understanding, not so much so that the kids listening would understand it, but so that I could understand while I was talking. You're like this too, I think, right? When you talk, you write on a whiteboard so that you can remember what you're saying. Yep. And so that it makes sense to you, even if no one else gets it. And so I'd set up and eventually gotten to this thing where I could do the catechism in an hour with these stick figures. So I took all of these pieces and pulled them all together into this book, and I really wrote the thing in about a year, because it was all already set there, and I just had to figure out I can't do it in Rick Warren's dogmatic categories. I got to put it instead in our category. And once I realized that, the thing just kind of took on a life of its own. So I don't know if that was what you wanted as an answer, but there's your author's interesting little bit about where the book came from.
That's fantastic. I appreciate that. Pastor Jonathan Fisk, author of Echo. Pastor Brian Wolfmuller here on Cross Defense. We got to get this book out, so stay tuned for plans for that. We'll talk about it more next week.
All right, so listening to that again, here's the thing that is why I think that's not just a story about how I figured out how to write this book. I think it's really important to understand that when you are trying to believe anything authentically, deeply, for real, right? Or even better, trying to take what you believe and communicate what you believe authentically and for real to other people. When you're trying to build a life upon what you believe that is not simply pie in the sky, it's not just you kind of wishing something toward the air, then the issue of first principles becomes pretty significant. What do I mean by first principles? By first principles, I mean the assumptions that you live your life by. Not the thoughts you come to, or the conclusions you make, or even the logic by which you make those conclusions, which is very important in its own right. Without logic, you're in quite a bit of trouble. But the things that you assume that can't be proven by logic, right? Logic itself is one of those things. When you make an argument, you are assuming that it is logical to be logical. You can't prove it. If I were to try to show you a math equation that proved the logical value of logic, I'd have to start at the end. And it's a fallacy in itself. You can't prove something that is its own premise. Why is the sky blue? Because the sky is blue. Well, that doesn't prove anything, right? So you have these first principles like logic that are groundwork. They are assumptions. And when you're talking about Christianity, one of these things, for example, is the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. One of these things is the existence of there being an almighty creator God. Now, are we just assuming this out of the air? No, not exactly. But when you're quote-unquote doing theology, when you're thinking about what it means to believe in God or communicating what it means to believe in God, or even better, having a conversation with another Christian about the impact of that existence of God on you, first principles, groundwork assumptions, are the common understanding that lets us build confession, that let us build a common union with each other in the words, right? To be of one mind. And part of what that means then, this first principles idea, that we have them, that there is such a thing as first principles, means that you can't just go and borrow first principles from some other worldview and have it not impact your own. You can't take the assumptions of a pagan about God and just kind of make them your own assumptions, or even take the words that they would use and make them their own words without bringing some of those assumptions with you. This is what the ancients meant a little bit when they talked about the law of lex orendi, lex credendi. As you pray, so you will believe. Or the law of speaking is the law of believing, and the law of believing is the law of speaking, which is to say that when you use words, eventually it's gonna change the way you think. The words themselves will shape your future thoughts, whether you know it or not, just by repeating them. And at the same time, your current thoughts should be shaping, or not should, will be shaping your current words. So if you see someone who's saying one thing, yeah, but not doing what they say, it betrays to you they don't really believe that at all. Because what they really are going to be doing is what they actually believe. Because the law of believing is the law of words, right? So they'd have to be, it's not that you would speak it, right? It's not just that you would have words. You can't lie. It's possible to lie to yourself and to others. But that what's in the heart is going to be shown by what's in the life, and what's in the life is going to influence what's in the heart. Yeah? You with me on that? So first principles are like that. And the thing about when I was trying to write a book about Lutheran theology with the categories, the first principle categories, the places for thinking about God developed by Enlightenment, rationalistic, pragmatic Baptist thought, no offense to you Baptists out there, but that's what it is. Well, it couldn't help but cause me trouble as I tried to figure out how to move out of their way of talking about the opening things about God, early things about God, into the things that really matter. How do you move on to baptism when you're dealing with Baptist categories? Yeah? Now, I actually just paused the recording for a moment and went and looked at the old copy of this book, Welcome to the Resistance, which, God willing, will be written someday, to try to figure out, okay, so what were these categories that were giving me so much trouble, so I could try to share them with you. And the state that the book's in, I had actually reinvented the entire opening category. Right? I totally changed the way it came at it from being about you, which is what Rick Warren's book's generally about, to being about the church, that the opening place of understanding your place in the galactic war that is light against darkness is to know that there is this church thing, this assembling being done by God outside of you thing, and that you're brought into that. Now, I'm not going to go off too much on a tangent on that, but where this becomes important now, if we can kind of extrapolate this. So I learned that by trying to use Baptist wineskins to put Lutheran wine into, ha ha ha, pun intended for you teetlers out there. when I tried to do that, it became so difficult that it was doable. Like, I could have finished it. It just would have taken me 30 years, right? It took me 5 years to write the first of 7 sections, right? But it was happening just very slowly. But what was so much easier and so much more effective was to use Lutheran categories instead, to just pull the substance of it right out of the middle of the heart of the thing, and put it into the words or the segments or the understandings, the principles. Put it in the first principles that we've been using for hundreds of years. Ten Commandments, Creed, Lord's Prayer. Boom. Done. Right? And then what we can learn from this, what you can take from this, is how you would approach things like tradition in the church, how you would approach things like dogmatic categories, And even the way that Echo itself, and we talked about this with Brian, I've talked about this with some others as well, I think this is tremendously important, that Echo is not attempting to replace the words of the Catechism in any way, shape, or form. Doesn't want to do that. We don't want to make up something new here. What we want is to retain something. We want to hold on to something that is more ancient and more great than any of us. We don't want to lose its meaning. Yeah, we want to be able to hear thou shalt not kill and know what it means in all of its depth, which is so much more than just don't actually shoot people, you know, in rage-inspired craziness, but actually is love your neighbor as yourself in his body. Look out for his good. So anyway, maybe that doesn't help, but for me, that's why that story is so important, that learning to forego the seemingly obvious and easy route of mimicking what is successful in the present American Christian age, letting go of that actually made for a far more, I think, ultimately, successful book. Whether or not it's popular is another thing, but far more successful book than I ever would have gotten to in years and years of trying to put a square peg into a round hole. Yeah. So Echo, what is it? What is it about? There's another question that was asked. I think Concordia Publishing House will be having a blog post about this. And I was asked the question, what's the meaning of the cover? Does that have a special meaning to you? And I don't know if I've said this elsewhere, but that cover was my design. I didn't draw it. Don't get me wrong. CPH drew it. They did a great job. They took my idea and then they made it better, right? But it was, I was the producer of it, if you can call it that, or I was behind the idea and I really, really wanted it. I'm going to tell a story here, and this is not meant to actually knock my fantastic editor, Scott Kinneman. Neither of my books, Broken or Echo, would be as clear or good as they are without his work. So I'm not trying to knock him, but it does have sort of a funny edge to it. Because I pitched the idea to him. I said, okay, so here's this book, Echo. I know you're really busy. 500th anniversary of Reformation. I want this thing published. Oh, and he's like, well, maybe a year and a half. So, okay, well, please fast as you can. This has got to get out. It's good stuff. And here's what I want for a cover. I want to have it be white with black typewriter letters that say Echo on it. And then I want a blood splatter across the front. And he kind of looked at me like, he's got this way of kind of, like he breathes deep, like, how do I tell this prima donna author what is so obvious and true, right? And what he says to me, which is a pretty standard knowledge, I think, I didn't have it at the time, but pretty standard knowledge within the world of publishing, he says, black and white covers, as a rule, do not sell. And I don't know if you know this about me yet, but I don't take any disagreement lightly. I always have a reason to like be right. And so I came right back. And what I came back with, I think made a lot of sense. I said, but there's blood on it, Scott. There's blood on it. Blood will sell. And he kind of said, he pauses and he says, well, I'll take it to the team. We'll take it to the team and we'll see what they come up with. Right. And so, what happens is, and I love this story, it's so awesome. So he takes it to the team. He makes good on his word. And as I think sort of as a caveat to me, like, oh, Fisk, we'll be nice to him. We'll have someone with our artist that we have here. We'll have someone make up his idea for a cover, but then we'll do our own ideas too. And then we'll kind of decide once we have our sketches, right? Because that's pretty common when you make a book. You usually have a couple covers to choose from, that kind of thing. So they let mine be kind of in the running. And I don't know, I've never seen what the other covers were like, but what I was told is that they were in the meeting with like these three or four different covers sitting there, and they're like talking about which one's best, which one's blah, da, 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 da. And they kept like going back to my cover and then like putting it back down and trying to get away from it, but they couldn't because it just kept drawing them back. And there's two things that I think are the reason for this. One is purely a first article, 10 commandments, this age, this design world, truth, a little proverb, a bit of wisdom from the business world. I'll show you that one first. And then the other one is a second article reality. That's why the cover is so important and so meaningful to me, at least. So the first is this idea that businesses or organizations or groups create rules in order to get better at something, right? So like back in the day, they're publishing a bunch of books and they're basically all without a cover at all. of any pretty kind. It's just words on the front, right? And over time, they start adding color or changing it or adding a picture or things like that so that don't judge a book by its cover, you know, becomes this phrase because it's a marketing ploy. You've figured out how to get people to buy it, not by what's inside, but by what you put on the front. And as they do this, they find that the more plain things, if you just had type print on the front of a white book, that doesn't jump out anymore because you're hungering for the picture. You're reaching for something more glamorous, something more cuddly and grabbable and shiny, right? You're walking through the forest and you see a red apple. Oh, I can see that. It jumps out at you. And that's been what has kind of moved marketing. I mean, in everything, whether it was the World of Everlasting videos with the pictures jumping across the screen, I mean, it's the same kind of idea. But here's the thing that the echo idea of white on black does. We have now reached a point where that rule has become so standard. It's become so ingrained that nobody would ever question it, that the single easiest way to make your book stand out amongst all the other books on a shelf ever, like if they're all face covering you and they're all sitting there and you're trying to like make yours jump out, is to go backwards, right? It's to end around. Is to do the thing that isn't common wisdom anymore. When common wisdom has become so common that everybody's doing it, if you want to leg up, sometimes you got to do the thing that everyone says you shouldn't do. And I'm not talking about morality here, right? I'm talking about rules we've made up for ourselves, particularly in a marketing context. Sometimes if you break the mold, you can actually, you can do something entirely different. And what I love this because when I was at the first time I saw Echo set up at a display case, it was so cool because you could actually look across the room at this Concordia Publishing House set of displays, and I'd see just all these books, and their covers have been great, by the way, recently. I've really been happy with the direction their cover design has gone. If you saw the covers coming out of that place in the 80s, I mean, let me tell you. coloring crayon would have gone further, I think, in my mind. But so all these beautiful covers are there, but like from 20 feet away, you can't really make any of them out. But you know what sticks out? Not like a sore thumb, oh, look, what's that? Yeah, he's got this book with a white cover and big black words and then a red dot on the front, right? So anyway, the bit of proverb that you can take and, you know, apply this pragmatically to your life is that when everyone says this is the way it's supposed to be done, sometimes the best way to do it better is to ask why, and then maybe just go ahead and do it anyway. Do it not the way it's supposed to be done. Go backwards, right? Because in a marketing world driven by the unexpected, the most unexpected thing is going to do something from 50 years ago that everyone says you shouldn't do. Yeah? Now, that doesn't really matter to me. It's fun. Like, I like it. It's a cool story. But what matters to me is what was even better about this. So yeah, so white on black, echo. The word echo, the book's about this. How the catechism is here forever, as different as light is from darkness, as different as black words is from a white page. It's something worth repeating, worth typing, worth stamping into print over and over and over again in big, bold block letters that just can't be missed. So that's just there on the cover. Type, 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 echo. Yeah. But then what is the echo? What is the thing worth repeating over and over again? What is the thing that should not be missed, that cannot be missed? Creation did not miss it. It's going to have an impact and an effect on creation itself. The whole creation's groaning with eager expectation, waiting for what has already been stamped on it to have its fulfillment in sight. And what is that? Well, obviously, it's the death of Jesus Christ. And I get this, I like to think of this as how I envision this book. And they caught it so well. So the echo of the cross, right? Just put the book with the word echo at the foot of the cross, and Jesus is strung up there hanging on it, and he's been whipped, and he's got spikes through his hands, and this trickle of blood runs off his elbow and falls, right? And there's like this glimmering moment in kind of movie style where the sun is covered by darkness and the clouds are rolling in and that drop is falling through the air and it's kind of silent. All the yelling goes away in this silent, surreal moment. And then splat, like right on the book, right on the echo. And the blood just flies out in every direction. And the point is not that it's actually Jesus' blood on my book, except for that it is. It's the point is that that's what's happened. That blood did fall off of Jesus onto the ground and splattered with an echo that continues to be repeated again and again and again, all the way down to you and me. And it's going to keep going until he comes back. And even through all eternity, that blood that splattered is the echo that will never die. That's why I like the cover. Because every time I look at it, I see Jesus for me. And I wrote it, well, you know, if you picked it up, right? I wrote it for you. Because that's what the gospel is. Jesus for you. It's worth repeating, isn't it?
Was that worth a dollar? What about five? If so, Pastor Fisk and his family would love to have it, in part to pay for technology and paperwork to keep Rev Fisk Raw going, and in part to just enjoy a night out together. Pledging $1.25 on Patreon, only $5 a month, lets the worker know his labor is appreciated. And if you're a true fan, you can give even more. You can find the link to Patreon in the show notes and check out the other giving levels there, including advertising your product, your family, or your congregation on Rev Fisk Raw. Lock and load, then rock on.